have a question. I was thinking about something you said about the second song.
Or get it closer or something.
Yeah, just a little closer.
Hello.
Yeah.
I was thinking about banks. That
yes.
The quote you said, their banks are their bodies. And then you made the distinction between beauty and struggle. And I thought, what if beauty is a struggle? Or is that, can that also be a part of it?
Beauty doesn't come without struggle. My mom says that it's those that are under pressure. You know, they always have the saying that gold has to be burned before it can shine. And the same thing with diamonds. It's just a piece of coal before, and after a whole lot of pressure, then the beauty is exposed. I have a question back for you, actually. When you talked about the Hurricane Katrina and the flooding, one of the things that my mom rescued me from was from flooding. As soon as she left, you know, walked like a month out of Ethiopia into Djibouti, then it rained and it flooded. And the image that I remember is a suitcase floating out of, the homes are submerged a little bit, so the suitcase was floating up and out of the doors. And I was very little, but it just, that image always struck me. So when I saw Hurricane Katrina, I was in Morocco. It was 2005, and I was looking at it like, my goodness, I remember that kind of an experience.
Well, it's funny because it's very odd seeing. I tell the story of, I used to have my mom drive me around New Orleans when I go back to visit. I've been away a long time, and I'd say, Mom, and I'll put the mic closer, and say, I've got to take pictures because one day this will be underwater and nobody will believe this was here. And so I took all these photos and then forgot about them. And then Katrina happened, and then we went back to my mother's house, and I realized I couldn't look at the city because it looked like, I mean, what, there was this incredible kind of residue. Right? And I remember floods as a kid. Floods were exciting for us as a kid, especially because we'd get the day off from school, we'd hear stories of people walking next to lobsters on the Nutri-Ground, when the tanks at Tipitina's crashed. So the idea of the kind of damage that could happen had never registered for me, really, until Katrina. And I couldn't look at the city except through the lens of a camera. And that was in order not to cry. So whatever footage I have, you hear the voice of my sister cry because she's looking at that. Mm-hmm. And
It's interesting that you're writing about a place that no longer, well, disappeared for a while because of kind of environmental factors, whereas our homelands are places that disappeared politically, like, you know,
mine is disappearing and appearing and reappearing.
Right. Well, okay. Mine's gone. Mine's gone. Like Biafra, like, is just a dream that everybody, you know, that short-lived. Mm-hmm. You know, this country that was not shaped by the colonial powers, but it was destroyed by its own countrymen. Mm-hmm. And you know, people still say we wait for Biafra to rise. We wait for a place where we'll be free. But you know, it's just one of those fantasies.
Well, I think waiting for anything is a waste of time. I believe that. No one's going to save you, so you better get to saving yourself.
No one's coming.
Yeah.
No one's coming. But for you, Faith, and both of you, you mentioned that being landless, you know, not having a land, what was it that you said?
I think it's to be despised.
To be despised.
To be landless in the new world. That's one of the...
So I'll enter a cognitive frame here. My people consider the world all ours, because we're one people, everyone in it. And so all of the earth is there for all of us. So there isn't this idea of being landless. If all the land is yours, you're the richest in the world. You know, you're wealthy. So there's that difference, you know, that framing. My framing was always, ooh, everything here is mine, so I'm rich. I never thought of poverty. You know, our people always, even If when we became refugees, we were unwilling migrants at that time, but we're naturally nomadic people, so we do move, and we believe that in movement you have growth, because it's never comfortable to leave where you are. It's never comfortable to be somewhere different.
Well, I have this phrase sort of like turning over my head, and it's the idea that there's the nowhere to which Blackness is said to belong, right? And that idea that there is not a homeland, and that certainly when I think of Katrina, I think of the way that New Orleanians were referred to as refugees, right? Within the bounds of the nation in which we're citizens. So that displaced, the language of displacement is sort of always ascribed to certain bodies and figures, or often described. Like, I love that idea of saying, well, everywhere is where I belong. That's incredibly expansive.
Yeah, so I see myself, you know, a little bit different. I see myself here, I'm an African American. Here, you know, where when we were kids, before we would go to somewhere new, because we're constantly going somewhere. So we thought we became wherever we were, you know. So if we were in an Arab land, we were Arabs. We thought on the outside we actually changed color and stuff. We had no awareness that we stayed the same on the outside, because we spoke fluently whatever language it was that we were coming into. So before we were coming to America, my cousin was like, you know, we're going to become white now, because the assumption is that everyone is white. Yeah. So we started choosing our hair colors and our eye colors. I'm like, really, our eyes have to change? Well, I love those blue eyes. I'm going to change mine to that. I thought it was a choice. So seeing things like, you know, from that child perspective, we had no awareness of what race is. And from the outside, America is seen as, oh, that's the land for whites. And the black people are dangerous. So that's why in our little innocent child ways, we automatically just chose, okay, I'm going to have blue eyes and that yellow hair. And my cousin was like, well, I'm gonna have that green eyes and the black hair. And my other sister said, I want that red hair. I think that's beautiful.
I actually did change when I went to Nigeria, because of course, being biracial here, I'm red as black American, African American, not seen as African at all, not seen as mixed. But when I went to Nigeria, I was considered white, and that was the shocking thing for me, you know, that wherever you go, people are following me shouting, Onyacha or Oyibo, which means, you know, white person. So, which of course makes sense depending on what's the standard, what's the norm. So if America is a white country, one drop will get you to be black, and if you're in Nigeria, which is a black country, being half white makes you white, but people can't wrap their mind around that, so I did get to shift.
Well, I think maybe not necessarily, because if you go to Somalia, they call me white too. Yeah. So it's, to them, white is foreigner. A coloring. It knows not just that, it's also shadism. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're not, to them the ideal is, my people, the ideal is having a chocolate skin, so anyone who is a little bit lighter than that, here comes, why are you, you know, a lot of people that I meet from my culture will say, why are you so white? You know, it's not complimentary.
It's very complimentary in Nigeria.
That's a whole other thing.
Okay, we have a question from the audience.
I wanted to talk more about the landlessness. I guess I'm curious to know how you cultivate your art when you feel or when you are landless.
Is that question for me?
Sorry, no, for
Tanya and Ruffy. I didn't think about being landless. Like, New Orleans is home. Yeah. And New Orleanians, I mean, and maybe this is people wherever they're from, but when you're from New Orleans, you try to bring New Orleans wherever you go, right? So we're talking, I went to Germany for a while to live, and I would have to make my mom stuffing. I didn't try to make gumbo. That would have been a little complicated getting the sassafras. But you kind of bring it with you, and New Orleans was this place, is this place that always struck me as being south of the south, more Caribbean in its sensibility. And so even though ultimately America got it from the French, there was still this incredible sense of, I mean, it has Congo Square, right? Which was the one place where Africans from all over Africa could gather and make music together, talk together on those Sundays, right? So there's that heritage that demanded that the place be known. What Katrina did was suggest the elusiveness of citizenship, right? Or the, not even the elusiveness, but the conditional nature, provisional nature of citizenship. And so I think, you know, Fred Moten talks about fugitivity and the sense of, I mean, when you talk about everywhere being your own, that sort of ability to keep it moving, to keep going, that somehow the art is about, I think, or comes out of experience, and is about making a new experience that cannot take any other form. Right? So the poem is a poem precisely because it conjures up an experience of place. I mean, much of this comes out of trying to figure out what's the language of New Orleans. What's the language that told me who I was, but that was also the language through which I spoke to myself who I was. And what I'm coming to, I think, is that language is always an approximation and failure. But I try anyway.
For me, it is the work. The work creates the home. And that childhood image of the creature, the Nordic Nigerian creature who would come and get me, then shifted. Like when I worked on this documentary called My Journey Home with PBS, and we went back to Nigeria. We went back to Nigeria for the second time, and then we went to this small town that I was raised, and I brought all my friends for the first time they came, and I just come back from Nigeria, and so they were saying, you know, what was it like, and where's home for you now, where's home? And I was like, this moment where my friends from all over the world have come to my village, and I noticed that every single person had at least one foot in a different culture. They were all like first generation immigrants, or they were mixed, or I was like, oh, This is the tribe, and this is the land that I've created, and it's not that I'm waiting for the place where I'll fit perfectly then. Like, I went to the village in Nigeria, and it was great, but I wouldn't want to live there. And I went to the village in Finland, and that was great, and I wouldn't want to live there. And I thought, wait, there isn't a place, there isn't this kind of perfect thing where I would fit perfectly, but that I could enter everywhere and fit a little bit, and that is the homeland that I've written it into being. I write it, and then people call me and say, I'm a weird mixture too. Let me join your tribe.
I also wonder, I was told to share my...
No.
No. I feel like I talk loudly enough that...
No.
Okay. It sounds loud in my head. I also think that where is when, right? That home is a moment, and that it's in those moments that, like, I moved here from New York. Now, mind you, New York was a fantasy of mine from third grade. So I remember standing up in Miss Turner's class. You had to say what you wanted to be. I said, I want to be a lawyer or a singer and live in New York. And so it was always this face in front of me until I got there. And then New York only became a space for me through the relationships that I had and the experiences that I had. And then that's when it became like home, although New Orleans was always the in my mind.
I agree with you on that. To me, home is time, where you are in that moment, what you're doing. So people ask me, do you ever feel out of place? And I'm like, well, how do you feel out of place if all of it is yours? If everything is yours, you walk into your house, it's your house. Do you ever feel displaced in your own home? So that's why I create spaces, you know. I will always go to a place and make it as comfortable as possible for me. If it's a park, or like you saw that alleyway dinner, it looked really glamorous, but it's just some lights and some fold up tables and chairs. But so the experiences, the things that we do, home is also the people.
I mean, we are in relation to each other. That, I mean, there's some point where I was writing about looking for relatives in Katrina, and I realized that I am wherever they are, that's the only me that exists, is the one that's in relation to them.
Can I ask a quick question? And so you keep speaking about New Orleans, and you mentioned language, and the last word that you ended on when you did your, when you read, was lanyap. And so language, New Orleans, ending there, I just wanted to kind of know if there was a reason for that, and if there wasn't for a reason, if there wasn't a reason, if you're kind of willing to maybe talk about the serendipity of that.
That's, wow. I didn't even realize that I ended on lanyap. It felt like I got to this moment and I thought, you've read enough. Stop. And so it may also be, like, I love the feeling of the word lanyap in my mouth. On like a visceral level, I really do. And so I thought, wow, that's a fun place to stop. Does everyone know what lanyap
no.
is?
No.
It's just a little bit extra, right? It's lanyap, it's a little something extra.
Can you use it in a sentence?
Let's see, can I use it in a sentence? I haven't heard that sentence in a while, or that question in a while. There'll be a little bit of lanyap in your bag.
When you go into a shop or something.
When you go into a shop, or a little bit of lanyap on your plate.
I said, I'm an eater. That's
all
I know about.
Yeah, if a hotelier likes you, if you go to a B&B, there might be a little something extra in the room when you get there. And in Jamaica, they call it brata.
Ah, brata.
Brata, B-R-A-W-T-A.
Nice. Is there a question?
I love your mention of the author who took a, I don't know, 20-year break. Yes, for activism, and then won a Pulitzer Prize. So can you talk about the pause that you take or don't take with art, or the intersection of sort of art and activism, and how you see that kind of playing out right now, and if all of you could talk about that a little bit?
On January 20th was my birthday. And there was a lot going on, and I should back up to November 8th, right? Or November? Well, I've been watching time travel sci-fi things. We all hope for a do-over someday. But I was in Missouri. And it's actually the day before the election, and I was giving a reading in a prison. And right before the reading began, I was looking through my book, and I heard a pop, and it was my hip. And I realized I could not, that I had to sit, that I couldn't reasonably support myself, and I was in a lot of pain, but there was no way I was going to leave what was about to happen. And I wasn't going to leave because it had taken me such a long time to agree to do work in a prison. And it had taken me a long time because I felt very clear that I didn't want to bring bullshit in terms of whatever it is I was doing, that I needed to have some grounding in what I considered real and substantive kind of work. And so there's something about, as I'm sitting here talking, I realized there was something about this election that it meant something for me to be there at that moment. So after that, it took, 2 weeks to heal or whatever. So January 20th is my birthday, and there's a lot of activity going on. And I genuinely had to shut down. I couldn't talk to friends. I had to shut down. Not to withdraw as much as to recover and sort of assess what's going on and to really decide what is it that I can do? What can I offer in this moment when things are a real kind of shit show? That's my response.
My mentor in graduate school, the late James Allen McPherson, whose mentor was Ralph Ellison, has this lovely essay called El Camino Real, in which and the setup is, it was after the Rodney King uprising in LA, and he's in a gated community writing. And then a homeless man knocks at the door, and it's not his house, he's just staying, someone gave him a place to stay in. And so he talks about how kind of startled he is all of a sudden to realize that he's in the world. And so he kind of links that back to kind of Aristotle's cave and the responsibility of the writer to go out in the world and witness what's going on and then retreat into the cave, into the belly of the soul, and process that and create art that points that out and sustains us, and then go back out on the royal road, and this kind of back and forth all the time. And I believe that the work is activism, that, as Toni Morrison says, it has, the best art is political, and it has to be unbearably beautiful and unbearably political at the same time. And so there is no separation. We'll be doing different things. Sometimes you're putting your body on the line to do your activism, and sometimes you're just telling the truth, not shutting up. And there's sometimes when you feel like you can't use your words, but it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, so you have to find ways to continue to be engaged, and I'm always trying to, even when I'm writing personally, I'm still using my body as a lab for the things that are going on in the world. So even that, oftentimes memoir is accused of being navel gazing, but it's like, no, it's all about kind of connecting with what's going on by being kind of truthful to the belly of the soul. And so.
Well, for me, I guess I've been through so many things that, when something new happens, we've been here before. So what I do is what we've done in all those times, and that is connect to my source. So for me, my source is I'm Muslim, and so I try to do my best to reconnect. That way I go within myself, and I connect with the source. And I sleep and eat because all my inclination is to run out and do something. I've got to do this and I've got to do that. I've got to organize this protest and I've organized a few, and I've got to do these dinners and these meetings, and that's my nature, is to be active and do something. And so in this time, it's been an exercise in taking care of myself, because the most revolutionary thing you could do is survive. No, is continue to exist. And, you know, all of this, you know, they and them, really, I have to remind you again and again, you know, as I connect to my source, I know I am a part of my source. In that same way, I view all people from that framework, that we are all separate pieces, but of one. So a lot of my new artwork is small pieces, but it connects to becoming one bigger piece or one unified piece. So in that same way, I think even, you know, these days I've been having these thoughts like, oh, maybe all these religious rules are to keep us off of each other, because we're so, if we're one, we're connected, so our inclination will be to be as close as possible if we love ourselves. And if we don't like ourselves, then we're going to try as much as possible to separate from one another and maybe even cause, you know, self-harm and then other kind of harm. So I've had friends, you know, at that Berkeley protest that just happened this last weekend, I asked one of my friends who's an anarchist, and he said, all you can do is come out with a bat, you know, and just start swinging. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, at first my shallow self laughed. You know, I thought it was funny because I was like, oh, look at all these people getting together and fighting as if, you know, it's middle school. But then when I thought about it, I was like, you know, this is really unfortunate, because they could have used that moment to see each, you know, the oneness in each other, to see that, okay, you voted for this man because you think he's going to save you, but I promise you, no one is going to save you. That's the only, you know, truth. No one is going to save you. It's, you know, you have to save yourself. Your conditions won't change until you make action to do that change. So a lot of rest, a lot of just, you know, if I feel like going out and doing a lot at that time, I'll drink some tea and, you know, talk myself down. I'll make a bunch of art. Oh my God, I've made a ton of art lately, you know, that I don't even have room for it, but I'll just make it, because for me, the art is the therapy. I can, you know, express myself without being out and engaging in inappropriate ways. It's kind of like when you get angry, count to 10. Kind of thing. So for me, it's when I get angry, get to work, make some art, and avoid, you know, engaging with people until I'm in a good state.
Unfortunately, we have to end. It's actually a great note to end on, to take care of ourselves. And I want to thank you all for coming, and thank you, Asya Abdelrahman, Faith Adiale, and Tanya Foster.